The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is the Columbia Calling Podcast. I am Richard McColl, your host here in Bogota, Colombia, and this is episode 503 at the end of January 2024. If you are in Colombia at the moment, you will have no doubt realized that we are undergoing a serious drought and, of course, suffering from the El Niño weather phenomenon. So please have us in your thoughts here as we try, as the authorities try and combat these forest fires around the country. It's not just located in Bogota, although from my apartment we can see flames at night and during the day and all day, every day. The brave work, the incredible work of the firefighters and the military flying their helicopters overhead with the Bambi baskets and dumping water on there. And thank you, of course, to those in Peru, Chile, United States and Canada, those governments who've sent over help in the form and the form of experts to come over and help with our forest fire problem. Anyway, as I said, this is episode 503. It's a great episode with Juliana Duque of New Worlder. NewWorlder.com is a great outlet platform started by the New York Times writer Nicholas Gill. And you'll remember he was on one of the first ever episodes, I think episodes 1 to 10, Nicholas Gill was on all those years ago when he came through Mompox and ended up writing an article about Mompox and the Casa Amarilla for the New York Times, so huge. Anyway, Juliana Duque is a food academic, and we're going to philosophize about food and Colombian food in particular. And as she says, and as we've discussed later on in the podcast, Colombian food isn't bland, it's subtle. So this will open the door to all sorts of praise and indeed contradictions and indeed criticism. So I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts on this situation, on this statement by Juliana Duque. And of course, a huge shout out to Emily Hart for last week's episode, which was truly, truly fascinating about zombie fungi, magic mushrooms, and this lesser known science of fungi. And really, it's one of those ones that I just stop and think, God, we have everything, don't we? We've covered everything, but we have everything here in Colombia. So thank you again to Emily for that, and of course her interviewees who shared their knowledge so unselfishly with her. So we are going to go over now to the news report from Emily Hart. Of course, for those of you interested in supporting the Colombia Calling podcast, just go to www.patreon.com/Colombia Calling. And in other huge news, the book that we published at the end of last year is now out on Amazon for print paperback editions. That's Better Than Cocaine, Learning to Grow Coffee and Live in Colombia by Barry Max Wills. You remember him from a few episodes ago as well. Well, we published it with our boutique editorial company, Fuller Vigil. It's available in 5 or 6 shops in Bogota at the moment, independent bookshops, but it's also available in ebook and paperback formats on Amazon, and it's selling very well. And check out the reviews, and they're not all my family, so there you go. Thank you again for listening this far. Don't go away, tune into the news, listen to some messages from our sponsors, and then a fascinating conversation with Juliana Duque in segment 3. So thank you again.
The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Columbia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Columbia Calling website, that's www.columbiacalling.co, or the BNB Columbia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your headlines from Colombia for this week. The government has declared a national disaster situation amid continuing forest fires, with 10 active fires still burning in the country as of this Monday morning. The most affected departments are now Boyacá and Antioquia. More than 300 fires have affected over 200 municipalities so far this year, consuming around 17,000 hectares of vegetation. 45,000 people have been affected by extreme weather phenomena during this cycle of El Niño, exacerbated by climate change. Many of these fires are caused by human activity, but the El Niño weather phenomenon has exacerbated heat and dryness, causing fires intended for deforestation or crop clearing to spiral out of control. Invasive species are also a contributing factor, with trees like eucalyptus and pine causing a drying of the environment. Around 300,000 gallons of water and 3 billion pesos have been spent fighting these fires. International aid has now started to arrive, including a 1,000-litre water system delivered from Peru, and more help expected from the United Nations, the European Union, the United States, and Canada. Around 1,000 municipalities are still on official alert for fires, and the dry season is expected to last until at least the end of March. Numerous emergencies are foreseen in the Amazon in coming weeks, with 8 other countries in Latin America also experiencing drought in their Amazon regions. The extremity of this El Niño cycle is also causing a rise in dengue fever in the region, prolonging the usual breeding season for mosquitoes. And Colombia's epidemic of violence against women does not look to be diminishing in 2024, with 10 femicides registered before the end of January. Last week, Diana Carolina Serna was murdered in the street by her ex-partner in La Unión, Valle de Cauca, in full daylight and in front of witnesses. Hernando de Jesús Suárez was on a legal 72-hour break from prison, despite a history of criminal violence, including domestic violence. Onlookers tried to save her, but she died instantly from machete wounds inflicted by her ex-boyfriend. Also last week, a man who had just killed his ex-partner's daughter was murdered by a mob in Buenaventura. The 13-year-old girl had reported to her mother that the boyfriend, Luis Ángel Rodríguez Paz, had assaulted her when they were left alone in the house together. He then stabbed the girl multiple times, and more than 100 people beat him to death in the street of the city of Buenaventura. The chief of police asked the population to give the justice system a chance to do its job. The lack of judicial training around gender and femicide contributes to high levels of impunity for these crimes, despite femicide having been included in the penal code in 2015. Of nearly 4,000 femicide cases brought to court since that date, 65% have yet to even see a verdict. The president of Congress is under investigation for links with paramilitaries, vote buying, and the ordered assassination of a Barranquilla councillor. The Supreme Court has opened an investigation into Iván Name over his alleged links with criminal group Los Rastrojos Costeños after the group's founder testified to his involvement. His cousin, José David Name, is also implicated. The foreign minister, Álvaro Leiva, has been suspended for 3 months over irregularities in the tender process for passport production, a $1 million contract. Last year, Leiva declared the bidding process void after just one company, which was already producing Colombian passports, tendered an offer. The company has also filed a lawsuit. The minister is among the most senior figures in the cabinet, but has faced criticism for certain diplomatic appointments, as well as for prioritizing negotiation processes with armed groups over other diplomatic interests. Another armed group may join the total peace policy. The Autodefensas Conquistadoras de la Sierra Nevada have agreed to meet with the government near Santa Marta this week. They also announced the cessation of violent actions in Santa Marta and the departments of Magdalena and La Guajira, asking additionally another armed group, the Clan del Golfo, to do the same during negotiations. The ASCN are located in a single region and are the smallest armed group among those negotiating peace with the government. They have around 1,000 members and are heirs to the regional bloc of paramilitary group, the Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia. Amid a military offensive to combat criminal gangs in Ecuador, Carlos Arturo Landazuri, alias Comandante Gringo, has been captured, the leader of a FARC dissident group, the Oliver Sinisterra Front of the Segunda Marquetalia. He has now been returned to Colombia. The group, accused of murdering 3 Ecuadorian journalists in 2018, operates in a large area stretching from the department of Nariño in the south of Colombia to the Ecuadorian province of Esmeraldas. After the wave of violence in Ecuador last month, President Daniel Noboa established a state of internal conflict with 22 criminal groups, as well as plans for a new intelligence unit, tactical weapons for security forces, new high-security prisons, and increased security at the country's ports and airports. The plan will reportedly cost $800 million, of which the US will provide $200 million, destined for the Ecuadorian army. Meanwhile, Colombia has recalled its ambassador to Argentina for consultations after the country's new president, Javier Milei, publicly called Gustavo Petro a murderous communist who is sinking Colombia. Petro himself had compared Milei to Adolf Hitler following another outburst in which Milei said that socialists are human excrement. At the World Economic Forum at Davos, the Argentine premier announced that he would not do business with so-called communists like China and Brazil, two of Argentina's main trading partners. He also called Pope Francis a disgusting lefty. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has asked for Petro's intervention in regard to the 136 hostages held by Hamas since the 7th of October last year, who include a Colombian citizen, Elkana Bobot. Since October, Petro has spoken out repeatedly against the actions of the State of Israel, which has now killed more than 25,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children. His statements, particularly via Platform X, formerly Twitter, have caused diplomatic tension with Israel. Those were your headlines for this week. I'll be back next Monday.
And we're back. This is episode 503 of the Colombia Calling podcast. We've had some great episodes of late. We started the year with episode 500 with none other than the world famous ballet dancer from Colombia, Fernando Montaño. Then we took up with, talked about the Hay Festival there in Cartagena, Jericó, and other places. And last week, Emily Hart took the reins and ran with it, talking about zombie fungi and other weird and wonderful things with experts in their fields. And I remember it's Mauricio Desgranados in New York and Aida Vasco. And I forget exactly where she is, but fascinating. Oh, no, she's in Medellin. Fascinating conversation there about a very unknown science, I would say. But this week, we have a very special guest known to foodies out there. You will have seen her name around because a rudimentary online Google search will throw up all sorts of links to her. is Juliana Duque, who is in Los Angeles and joining us today. She is a sociocultural and anthropology PhD from Cornell. She sort of focuses on the analysis and production of food and its relationship between tradition and culinary innovation. Did I get that right, Juliana?
Yes, that's
okay.
<right. laughs>
I would like to say that you are a food academic.
Well, thank you. That's flattering. I have done some of that work. Yes, I do have different hats depending on interest and, you know, possibilities. But yeah, that's part of my background.
Well, I think it's fascinating because, of course, we take food for granted, obviously. But those of us who enjoy eating out and enjoy trying things, we still take it for granted. Oh, this is amazing what's arrived on my plate and stuff. One quick digression is that when I do a research for Juliana Duque, the first person who pops up is the former first lady, Maria Juliana Duque.
Oh, no. True, yeah.
So let's not talk more about her, but equally so, you share your name with the former first lady.
Yeah, I know. I share her name and the last name of the expression. Yeah,
I know, it's funny. But anyway, you're in Los Angeles, and she's probably, I think she's in Northern Bogota, further up from Usaquén. But anyhow, that said, it's absolutely fascinating what you're doing. And I know now that you are a co-host on the New Worlder podcast with Nicholas Gill, who writes for the New York Times and other places and has been, well, he's been around for a long time as, like, I would say, a restaurant food critic. And I mean, the guy knows his stuff. And he tells the stories, but you come in with the hard facts, I think. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's our goal. Well, first, thank you for inviting me here, Richard. This is great. It's my honor to be part of this diverse showcase of Colombianness and interesting things related. So, yeah, I think Nicolas has a privileged eye, you know, to capture things with his camera and a privileged mind to translate that in words. So that's great. He's a storyteller. And my mind is analytical by nature, I guess, and my background in philosophy. And then, yeah. So yeah, that's the idea. Got it right.
You've taken philosophy, and you've studied in Bogota, the Universidad Nacional. You've taken philosophy, and you're applying it to this culinary landscape. How does that work?
Yeah, right? Not a straightforward path.
No.
I was always interested in food and what food creates for people, connections, you know, obviously joy. But there was always something interesting for me happening at the table or kitchens or even, you know, in parties, people gathering in the kitchen. So I always found that fascinating. But being so analytical and interested in concepts forever, I thought that I could link these two things. Obviously, at the time, it was not that planned and calculated. It was kind of intuitive, but I was finding my way to that now that I see that in retrospective. So when I graduated from philosophy, I started working as an editor, but I was very stubborn in just doing things related to food, which was not easy because, you know, how many publications at the time and even now. But I did that, and then I went to find a middle, even a better link or a more explicit link between these two things, which was anthropology, which gives you the theoretical framework founded in philosophy, but it gives you the space to apply that to a specific topic like food and cooking in specific places at a specific time. So, yeah, this was kind of magic. And you know, I got a scholarship. So I went to Cornell for my PhD. And then, you know, one thing led to the other. And I ended focusing on analyzing Colombian, as you well said, you know, traditional and new cuisine for, you know, interpretations of it and new trends and
And when you look at this from an anthropological view, do you also take into account, you know, the family sitting down together? What are the
towards the relationship with the event, that may be a family getting together, or do you say, no, well, you know, I would say people in Medellin will get together every Sunday, all 50 members of the family, and have an asado or a barbecue, whereas maybe in Bogota they sit down to have, you know, ajiaco. Is there a relationship as well to place, time, and the event in your anthropological research?
Yes, definitely. I food is meaning, so everything is charged with meaning, right? The way of serving it, the way of cooking it, the way of eating it with people, without people, festive, daily. You know, there is so much. Everything is telling you something. So it's hard to capture every detail of it. So you kind of need to decide what are you going to look at specifically at some point. So you can focus on food events, how these events happen. I think because of my passion for, I guess, abstract structures and, you know, just categories and all these, I have been trying to understand if there is a structure that is more universal in terms of how tradition interacts with innovation, and if this is part of the historical natural way in which, you know, processes and culture happen, and how these habits are reinterpreted, what are the new elements, what is cosmopolitan, what is like reflecting what is going on in the rest of the world, what is unique from Colombia, what is lost, what is kept, and why. So, you know, yes, I look at all that in my daily life, and I'm always, you know, looking at those things you said, like, oh, how interesting, you know, that these people do this here and not like always. But I guess in a more systematic way, I try to focus on that relationship, tradition, innovation.
It's a fascinating thing. And what you say in that last intervention raises so many different facets of life, not only international, globally, but in Colombia. And I think of, you know, you don't go to someone's house in Colombia and they will always serve you food. It doesn't matter what time, where you are. It is that, I don't know, is it a familiarity? Is that a way of inviting you into a family embrace? Is this something that you've looked at all? Why? Because in England, this wouldn't happen, you know?
Yeah. I think, it's definitely related with hospitality and being a good host and, you know, hold you, right? Like, it's inviting. And I think there are places in which that is more directly expressed through food. And, you know, I think it coincides with cultures and countries in which families or communities are maybe stronger and, you know, more part of daily life. So we have to rely on family, friends, networks to go through, right? Yeah. Because, you know, some things are harder. So I think that is all related. So the more community-based a society is, the more you are going to see these expressions through food and daily gestures, like come over for, you know, a snack, come over for lunch, come over for dinner, come on. So it's a direct way of welcoming you. I said, like, you are welcome here. You are part of this. And I want to pamper you too. So it's such a powerful language, right? Because that's what it is. Food is a language, and it's so natural and caring and delicious and fun and inviting, and it's just great. So, yeah.
Well, I think that because, I mean, you know, if I'm going anywhere, I remember not to eat too much before going there, because I like my food, and, you know, my waistline is testament to that. But if we go on, you said something as well, as like, you know, food reflecting the time or reflecting what's going on, maybe in the world, but again, in Colombia. I have to ask, is there food unique to Colombia? Because, you know, we look at it, we look at the ajiaco, look at the bandeja paisa, which I routinely say it's an English breakfast made Colombian. But we look at these things and yes, they are dishes, but is there something that we can say that is uniquely Colombian?
What you just said, I think it's great because yeah, the answer is there in what you just said. And I find fascinating that connection you just made between bandeja paisa and an English because I agree. I mean, it's exactly a version of that. So my answer is yes and no. Yes, because every cuisine is local and unique. There is no way you can translate something that is happening in a specific time and space. There is no way. It's logically impossible. So that counts for every cuisine. Yes, it's unique and it's local. And what it's called terroir and, you know, this like unique flavor you get from, sorry, but if the Colombian coffee doesn't taste the same there than it tastes here, or it just doesn't, right? Yeah. And it's because of all that environment that affects the final flavor and experience. Mm-hmm. So yes, it's unique. Definitely, but at the same time, as you just said, and I think that's a perfect example, I think there are categories and patterns that repeat everywhere across the world because we have infinite creativity and new ways of recreating things, but there is a certain amount of element we have to play with, right? Mm-hmm. So we find the same categories in terms of things that are that have a filling and a bready dough in which they are wrapped, or, you know, leaves or like patterns that you can find in different places. So, you know, cooking is cooking. There are certain universal culinary techniques too. And the difference is like, how do you, the final combination of all these categories in a specific time, space, and historical moment, because that's key too. So that's where the differences are, I think. And that counts for every cuisine in the world.
When we look at historical moments, obviously, I mean, we're in Colombia, there are all sorts of issues going on here. Is there any way that, let's say, the long-running conflict has affected food and preparation or dishes and so on? I mean, is there a way that the culinary landscape has been affected by Colombia's contemporary violence?
Yeah, I think, if you look specifically at how the movements directly involved in these conflicts eat, of course, there is something going on there, you know, like guerrilla movements, but then the army or communities that were displaced and how they diets change. Of course, mm-hmm. you will have to look specifically for how that historical moment affected every community, right? But I think there is another way in which more psychological maybe and more identity-based as a nation, which is... the process of reconciling with our identity as Colombians affects the way in which we see our way of eating, our food, our products, and if we value that more or less. So I think the less we are ashamed about as we are as a country, the more we appreciate what is, as you said, unique of our country. So, oh, look at this. You know, we have a lot of products, amazing colors, flavors, endless fruits, flowers, ferments, beverages, herbs. I mean, so much. Why all of a sudden, quote unquote, because it's not all of a sudden, it's a process, we are appreciating that more. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it coincides with the deal, with the peace deal process, mm-hmm. and the question and the you know, like delabeling us over time as just a country that traffics illegal drugs and, you know, or that it's in constant war, internal war. So I think this is not a coincidence. And the more we find different ways of expressing what we are, and the more we ask ourselves, like, wow, this country is changing. Maybe we have different ways of living. Maybe we can create new scenarios. The more we look at food and the kitchen and restaurants and everything related as an opportunity to explore that, right? So I think so. At the same time, I don't think this is unique of Colombia in the sense that there are new trends that are applicable to what's happening in Colombia. And that's what what's happening now shows too, you know, focusing more on local stuff. As part of, I think, a general dynamic of the world, and again, I think this is a natural rhythm of history, we are always trying to find the balance, the right balance. So if we went too globalized, then, oh, we need to balance that with being local again. And I think this is happening all around the world with, you know, people cross, like, try to control frontiers and all that. It's like, wait, we went too global. So now it's like kind of, okay, what can we see as closer and unique and more differentiated? Because when flavors become standardized and just, you know, just anonymous, it feels tasteless in a way, right? So I think that's a universal thing right now. I think everyone is trying to go local again just because, you know, we went, I mean, globalization was going too fast. And so, which is, you know, it's how it is. That's how history, this constant balance of, well, where do we want to be, right?
Spoken like a true philosopher there, and bringing the sociology into the sort of free trade agreements and so on, which of course have obviously affected food patterns. But one thing that is so very exciting, as you say, is the capacity to be able to get the food from the farm to your plate in the same day. Here in Colombia, for example, you know, in the morning, if you're in Bogota, it comes from, like, let's say, Altiplano Cundiboyacense. And friends of mine who come very well traveled, very well eaten, will always say, what we notice the most has not been the spectacular dishes, but the freshness of the food. And that's what I appreciate the most as well. You can do amazing stuff with the food, but you notice it has come directly that morning and is now on your plate at lunchtime. And I think that's one thing. I think that the whole idea of reflecting the historical moment and so on is very interesting. And when we talk about, like, the local traditional dishes, such as said ajiaco, I'll say bandeja paisa, or sancocho, or other things, even if you go up the Caribbean coast, some fried fish with the plantains and rice and so on. And my father-in-law, who's from the sort of interior coastal area, is not happy unless he gets, like, sort of you know, plantains, pasta, rice, potatoes, and then some protein on there. But these are all foods that reflect, in my opinion, that you were going out to work the fields afterwards. This is, you know, to give you the stamina to go out there, because this is food that you pile up on to work off. This is not something you can eat every day. So I'm very happy to have been here to experience an evolution in the cooking procedures, because everyone says, oh, you have to try this, it's traditional, you have to try that. But I can eat these things once a month or once a year. The bandeja paisa, once a year, and I have to be so hungry. The ajiaco, maybe once a month, once every 2 or 3 months, because I'm not going out to work the fields. I'm sitting at a desk. And this has to be changing as well. What I'm seeing, you know, I live in an area of Bogota where lots of offices, and Colombians, for example, they love their lunchtime. It's the principal meal of the day. But I'm seeing an evolution in the style. You know, previously, either they'd go to the corrientazo and you'd get your soup, and then your main plate, and then a little postrecito, usually something, you know, like a why am I or something, you know? And I'm seeing a change in that. Not only, well, people take their own food, but eating fast to get back to the office. Mm. And this to me is, it's a bit sad because, you know, you can see more packaged sandwiches and wraps in the supermarkets and like meal deal type things that we've had obviously in the UK and the US for a long time. Have you noticed this taking place in Colombia, this evolution of the way that people, you know, they've got to get back to the office or eat at their desk to continue working?
Absolutely. I mean, first thing to say, I noticed you're half Colombian by now because you use the diminutive for postrecito. That's, like, you know, there is no way back. So, definitely. I think that as digitalization happens at different rhythms in different places of the world, the same happened with industrialization, right? So I completely agree with you in which freshness is still the best quality of most Colombian products, not all, because we do have a lot of mono crops and, you know, even imported foods, right? But for the most part, I think what you mentioned at the beginning, it's just our probably most important treasure to protect, yeah. Freshness. That said, yeah, we are a country in which obviously industrialization happened and you know, the different lifestyles, and because it's not linear and because we live in these hybrid societies that still take a little bit of past lifestyles, but then a little bit of this new one, it's just not binary, you know, it's not black and white. So you see all that happening in real life. So when you say like, oh, yeah, people still here crave the corrientazo or a version of it, but they don't have enough time to do that. So I think there is an important difference to make here, which is like, one thing is you are like enjoying or tasting a traditional dish, but not in the traditional way of eating it. It's different, you know?
Interesting.
So I think that's part of what you're saying. You might be eating this stew, lentils stew, and the structure of the corrientazo, but the way of experiencing that traditional food is not the same one because it's framed by office hours, you know? So, and that's why I think adaptation to new scenarios, as you said, maybe you still crave the English breakfast, but you just do part of it, not the whole thing, because you're going to be, you know, seated there. Or you have to space it up with, okay, maybe today I eat granola or just a tea as a piece of toast. And then maybe on Friday that I have more time, then I go for the, you know, original version. So I think this adaptation is constantly it's happening in real time every day. And that's why I find difficult to define what is traditional food, because traditional food is changing in real time too, in the way we are experiencing that. So we can try to define it, but I prefer descriptions more than definitions because they feel more exploratory and less restrictive because of that constant movement. So
again, the philosophy and the philosopher in you keeps coming.
I can't help it. You know, there was a time, not to talk psychology here, but there was a time in which I am realizing I can't help my identity as a philosophy. So let's embrace it. And, you know, it's just, that's how it is. That's my way.
I mean, if you got me on my chosen subjects as well, you just start bringing it out. And this is what I want from a conversation, because your enthusiasm shines through. And that's what my listeners will love. They will love it on this level, and obviously all of it. Now, I'm going to change it up a little bit. And I did write you an email earlier in the week to somewhat prepare you, because I've been listening to a podcast about the reparations by families who descended from, you know, whose families gained their wealth from slavery. In particular, it's Laura Trevelyan, who is the BBC correspondent for the US. And she found out later that her, I don't know, great-great-great-grandfather or something was a huge slave owner in the island of Grenada. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's been a reparation thing, and she's apologized, and there's been a foundation set up. But I don't want to talk about that particularly. One of the episodes of the podcast discusses the health issues suffered by the descendants of former slaves in an island in the Caribbean, like Grenada, because their traditional foods, the food that they ate back then, which were the leftovers from their master's table, so the fatty stuff left over that people didn't want to eat, has now become like Grenada's national dish. And it's obviously a very fatty food, very high in cholesterol. And given this practice, and given this practice from the past of having eaten that almost on a daily basis, there's been a genetic evolution, meaning that the descendants of these slaves, you know, have a propensity for heart disease and other such things. And I wonder, because, you know, we have a huge community of descendants from former slaves, you know, and think about a town like Palenque up near Cartagena, or just think of Cartagena itself, and then along the Palenques, along the Caribbean coast. Have we seen similar issues taking place in Colombia or elsewhere from descendants from eras such as this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I obviously, from a medical point of view, I have no idea what's happening in terms of, you know, that in the Caribbean coast or the Pacific coast. But I mean, in terms of numbers, but of course, you know, diets that are too heavy on fried things, especially in a context in which it's again hybrid, because one thing is this food, you know, I imagine, as you mentioned, slaves trying to adapt to whatever was available. Later on, they had a way of having their own mini crops and, you know, gardens. So maybe diet was a little bit more diverse. But at some point, it was just leftovers and dishes out of creativity with three or four products available, usually not very, you know, healthy or based on diversity. So that balance was lost. And when that balance is lost, there is that increasing in health issues, right? Because there is nothing wrong with frying as a technique. There is nothing wrong with oil as a product, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of balance. So I think that happens when certain things are lost in translation. So when products travel, when through slavery, obviously there are things lost in translation, which is the context in which all these things were used and combined with what, in which ecosystem, right? If you can use just part of it, then, you know, there is probably going to be an imbalance, for sure. And in the case of the Caribbean coast of Colombia, a little bit less in the Pacific, where there are more stews, and because coconut milk is so much the base of the way in which things are cooked, then maybe oil is less used, right? But mesa fritos, this fried showcase of things in the Caribbean coast, it's so part of the culture there, right? That it becomes not only a source of pride and enjoyment, but something that has commercial outcome, right? So that affects to how much people eat this, and you know, it becomes like, I like it because people do it and because it's part of what we eat. So it's a cycle of embracing that because it's done, but then, you know. So definitely, I think these processes coming from migration in different formats, in this case slavery, happened in the Caribbean too. And you can see it. And I think because Afro communities are evident in the Pacific coast and the Caribbean coast, and oil, fried foods coming from there, from their food waste, it's something they kept. But again, the problem is that combined with what and in which context? And again, the urban lifestyle has to do a lot with it.
Yeah.
Because one thing is, you know, these communities working on the field all day and not working on the field, but just selling on the street or just going to eat an arepa huevo in the morning and then go to the office. Yeah. Then it's going to.
It doesn't help, but it's like though when we come back to that first point, the whole issue in Montbos, for example, it's about 5 PM where everyone goes and looks for fritos. So they go and get the kibbeh, obviously from the descendants of the Lebanese, so the Christian, the Christians from Lebanon who left during the Ottoman Empire, and you get the palito de queso, and then you know, heavily fried arepa or something. The arepa de huevo, of course, in the morning, but there is a community sense to it. There is definitely going, walking up, finding the lady with the little display cabinet or the plastic box with them in. It's fascinating, and you know, there's a whole, I would say, a social interaction around this as well.
Definitely. I mean, these are foods that are easy to carry. They travel well, right? They are easy to put in these vitrinas or you know, just like little food trucks or versions of that. So that definitely, and you know, it's like something. I mean, it's indulging in a way, right? So you want to share those things with your friends because it sounds like fun too, or with your family or with your neighbor. But I have a question about that, and I don't know if you have an answer for that. I it's puzzling for me. I struggle with this. Why more of these community foods are not vegetable based? Why these festive, you know, casual street food things? I know it's hard to preserve them. Maybe it happens with fruits more. You know, like you see all these carritos with fruits, of course, all around Colombia and Mexico and Central America. But why is not more vegetable-based? It's because we were not trained that way, because our traditional regional foods were not heavy on veggies, like for example in Asia they are, because you know, even street food in certain parts of Southeast Asia is more heavy on veggies. So I don't get this, because we have so many, and you know, but that said, there are regions in Colombia in which there are 3 or 4 you know, tubers, roots, and no greens. So
I love this question because it's something I grapple with, especially on the coast, because I'm up there all the time. And, you know, where are the vegetables in this? And, you know, it's gradually coming in because we've built in it. But, you know, for us, having built an industry for tourism, we have to have more, but for the food to offer. But, you know, avocados, of course, key. And my family, for example, will eat avocados, and of course they're from the region or not far away. Fruit, as you know, is we don't lack it. What I love about it, of course, as well, is the seasonality of it, the importance of a season. The guys, as we call them, the piñeros, who arrive from Pinillos, and they take the boats up from El Banco full of a pineapple, and then as soon as they've sold them all, then they go back. And I love this kind of thing, you know. We know it's in papaya season from Morrison and Cesar, and we know it's this and that. But vegetables, and I've talked to my extended family about this, and they don't ever recall eating vegetables, even in their childhood. The vegetable was a potato or yuca.
Exactly.
And they talk about yuca with such, you know, with such joy. Oh, it was delicious. And I'm like, this is really just
comfort food.
it's not delicious. It's a necessary food, you know?
Yeah, it's a staple.
And they talk, oh, yeah, but that one was great. And I don't know how you... Well, anyway, that's just me being close-minded towards it. But I think that previous to that, there was more fruit and vegetable. I think over time, you know, the difficulty of cultivating in these areas it's the tropics. Everything eats everything. And I just think there's a difficulty in doing that because...
Preserving foods too, right?
Yeah. And in my research, I am writing about Mompos, but in my research, I found that in the indigenous periods, prior to the arrival of the Spanish, people didn't suffer from similar ailments that they did later on, similar illnesses, because there was a trade route. The indigenous communities from the highlands and from the other places exchanged the food. So people, let's say, if you were down in the Depression Momposina, but you've got your fish and you've got yuca and other things, let's say, plantains, they were getting fruit and vegetables from areas, I would say probably Santander, probably Antioquia, what they're known as today, which then diversified their diets and their intake of minerals and vitamins. Then when the Spanish arrived, they cut these links by isolating the indigenous people. And then later into the Republican era, for example, in Mompos, I found old diaries from travelers who find that the women in particular were suffering from something called coto, where your neck swells up.
Yeah,
is that coto? Yeah. Is that a lack of iodine or something? I can't remember.
Yodo.
Yeah. And that is a direct consequence of the establishment of the Spanish colonial control over areas and separating them. So I think we've seen a whole evolution of this. And then later on, you know, we are now only getting our fruit vegetables from, most of them come in from Antioquia, and they don't look so happy by the time they've arrived in Mompos.
Yeah.
You know, it's the freshness isn't there.
Yeah, I think that's, there is something as not only social potential isolation or alienation, but something as isolation and alienation from the environment or the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, which is what you are saying, like distance from the fields, distance from the gardens, from the crops, and then distance from, if not the fields, access to other communities that had access to that you were lacking, and then you were complementing, right? If you are isolated from that ecosystem, then there is an imbalance, and then you see all these things that are missed in the sites. I also think when you have to choose and prioritize, you are going to prioritize calories. Because, you know, if there is like a survival mode, if there is not enough money, if there is not a direct access to these things, you are going to prioritize calories. And that combined with marketing, which marketing obviously affects taste, and taste is shaped by marketing. And if marketing is not promoting and motivating you to eat greens and veggies, but sodas, packaged food, or just starches and these heavy, rich in calories dishes, then that is reinforced too. I think with the yuca, and I think you're right, you know, palates are different. Colombians have been accused of having a bland, you know, bland food, because many of these foods are, you know, a mote de queso, it's not a tortilla mexicana. It's very soft flavor. And so it's subtle in flavors most of the times. But I think that when they tell you, this is delicious, what are you talking about? This is delicious, I miss it, is the emotional connection. Who was preparing that food? You know, the grandma, the mom, the aunt, and in which context? So it it takes you to that place of love and care. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it is. It can be a toast with, you know, with like the song of a stink. Like I like my toast, you know, and tea instead of coffee, even when I'm in New York, is because it doesn't matter what it is. It can be a piece of toast of a piece of boiled yuca. But if that takes you to a place of love and care and safeness, you're going to crave that and find that delicious.
That's really interesting, because now I want to use that quote, Colombian food isn't bland, it's subtle.
Oh, yeah. I had this, you know, with the director of this Netflix documentary I was consulting for with Danny. Like, sorry, Julian, but this soup, it's just tasteless. And it's like, no, it's subtle. You feel the freshness of the artichoke. That's why.
That's really great. That's fantastic. I think I'm going to title this show because I get a lot of comments about people talking about the blandness of food, but maybe that, you know, elsewhere we overdo it with condiments.
I try to prepare people like, hey, this is not, you know, it's not bland, it's just subtle. So, you know, go to that mindset and you enjoy it.
I think that's fascinating. Actually, that's probably the best way to wind this down. But I have a couple more comments for you quickly. That now we have seen an evolution in, like, let's say the restaurant selection in cities like Medellin, Bogota, Cartagena, or, you know, main cities, and it's been great. It really has. It's you know, and I've had people on here doing that sort of thing, talking about their restaurants. Are there any that you would recommend to a first-time visitor to Bogota or Medellin or Cartagena? It's like, this is where you should go for a new concept in let's say, Colombian cooking.
New. Are you talking specifically of new place?
New. Yeah, I don't want traditional. Yeah. We can go to the, you know, was it the Puerta Falsa for traditional? We can go to somewhere.
Yeah, traditional. You go. Yeah, I think traditional you cover with farmers market. Invited to family meals. You cover that too, and if you know street vendors. So that's how you cover traditional. And little puesticos all around. Then you can cover traditional that way. Mm-hmm. But if it's for new contemporary interpretations of Colombian or, you know, versions of that, well, so many, and I don't want to get in trouble here because you are always going to leave someone you know, outside the picture. But I'll say, even when it's not the only list, I think in like the 50 best Latin American and the world list, you can find places that have been working for a while in this creation. So, you know, Mesa Franca, Salvo Patria, Prudencia in Bogota, Leo, El Chato, these new ones, Deborah, Oda, you know, so many now, more and more. And Medellin, there is, I forgot his name now, Bombi Bistro, obviously Carmen and Rob.
Juan Manuel Barrientos, is it? Juan Manuel
El Cielo. El Cielo. Yeah, I think he has been focused lately more on the U.S. Version of his restaurants. Yeah. But I think he still has El Cielo in Medellin. Carmen and Rob, Zambombi, Bistro. In what else did you say?
Cartagena.
And I was going to mention Jaime from Celele, because I think he's trying to make this... you know, like to nourish his restaurants and obviously his clients with more veggies, fruits, and colors from the region. You know, fruits, flowers, and vegetables, and grains, and everything. So definitely Celele in Cartagena, but there are others in Cartagena too.
I love that I've been to them all.
That's great. Good for you. I'm jealous.
You know, you try and also you go, you know, and you, at the beginning, it's always hard for people. And then there's some great places, you know, and it's so exciting to see this change. It's
and
so
I think exciting. The key, I mean, honestly, I think that like in every place, the balance between having a taste of a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. Then you can have a good picture of the country. You know, don't only try the new ones. Try, you know, just eat an arepa somewhere there. Go to a fresh farmer's market. Go to the plaza. Go and then go book in a fine dining restaurant in a contemporary version. And then you get all of it, right? Yeah. So,
yeah. Let's promote you a little bit here. We've got your book here, Sabor de Casa. 12 maneras de hacer la cocina colombiana y la historia de sus protagonistas. So there you go. Yeah. I've seen that's available around. Of course, Juliana is on the New Worlder podcast with Nicholas Gill, who you will know because he's a food writer for the New York Times and others. This has been a real joy because I genuinely believe that food must have joy and happiness in it, and you have expressed that not only through philosophy but really a bottomless energy and knowledge. So thank you so much.
No, thanks to you for saying that. I mean, yeah, obviously it makes my day, but thank you for inviting me, and I agree with you. I think food, in the end, it has to taste well, and the point is enjoying it because it has to nourish you in many different levels. And if it's not, then that's a sign of something too, and then we have to explore why, and then we'll have some answers. But thank you so much. This is my pleasure, Richard.
No, and I know that my listeners will really enjoy this because the enthusiasm comes through. So remember, everyone, you've been speaking to or listening to Juliana Duque, who holds a PhD in sociocultural anthropology from Cornell. And she, as you no doubt heard, she makes an analysis of the production of food and its relationship between tradition and culinary innovation. And I think we covered that. Not just in Colombia, but elsewhere. It was all mentioned in there. So it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to Juliana here on the episode 503 of the Colombia Calling podcast. We'll be signing off now with some messages from our sponsors. But of course, should you wish to help the podcast, myself and Emily, you can sign up to patreon.com/Colombia Calling and throw a couple of dollars, less than the cost of a Starbucks coffee, at us with their highly roasted coffee. Don't say anything, Julian. Anyway, thank you so much, Julian. It's been a real pleasure. Hopefully we'll meet sometime in the future in person.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely day in Bogota, Richard. Yeah. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and Latin News.com. www.thecolumbiacalling.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.